Hi, Agnes here. You're listening to Two Queers, Five Books, a podcast that has sprouted from the soil of another podcast, Two Queers, Four Questions. Ezra and I are moving through the annual cycle of Torah readings week by week, taking turns with each parsha, wrestling with the text, dancing with it, flirting with it, arguing. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy. Truma. This week's drash is dedicated to Cecilia Gentili, who passed away last week. She was kind of a legend. Activist, mother, storyteller, performer. If you don't know her or her work, there are all kinds of interviews and profiles, and her book, Faltas, is funny and moving and complex. One of the deepest reckonings with something like a moral order that I've read in a long time. She had a huge impact on many people's lives. I'm still a little shocked she's gone. I see part of her legacy as an invitation to consider how huge a life can be, how much fight it can hold, how much humor, how much joy, how much love. She was also funny as hell and described herself as a grudgy bitch, so no sanitizing, please, just what a fucking woman. Zichrona livracha. It feels fitting that this week's parsha then is about the building of a house. A house that was, if you'll excuse my language, glamorous as fuck. All acacia wood and gold and silver, ram skin and dolphin skin, copper instruments and the finest yarn of blue, purple, and crimson. Linen woven with a pattern of angels filled with incense and spiced oils. I can see it in the desert now, glowing and billowing, light and mobile like a cloud, and also solid, formidable like a rock. God is talking to Moses. Let the people build me a sanctuary, she says, that I may dwell among them. I'm not the first to hear this parsha as an echo of the story of creation. Jacob Bar Isi says, the tabernacle is equal to the creation of the world itself. And in Midrash Tanchuma, he gives us an elaborate set of correspondences, God stretching out the heavens like a curtain, and here we are supposed to stretch out a curtain, etc. And I love this. To build a meeting place, a place for encounter between humans and between humans and the divine, is to build a world. That already is Torah enough for me as theater maker, all the world's a stage, etc. But there is something heartbreaking, too, in all the ways that this moment is not like creation. In creation, of course, God speaks things and they are done. It's immediate, no gap. The word is the doing, the speaking of the word is the becoming. But this is different. Speaking has been sundered from making. Language is no longer a doing, it's a preparation for doing. God is speaking, is giving instruction, but the instruction won't be fulfilled until much later. And there's the horrible dramatic irony to it too, knowing that even as God is speaking these words to Moses at the top of the mountain, the people at the bottom are starting to murmur to each other. The promises they've just made to God not to worship idols are beginning to be forgotten. I wonder if the gathering of the materials for the golden calf is not happening literally as God is describing how she wants us to gather materials for her own home. I see God in her frilly pink prom dress. She's telling Moses how much she loves her boyfriend. She's telling Moses that she wants him to take her out to a certain restaurant after the dance, that she wants him to bring her certain flowers and a certain kind of chocolate. She's talking about what they're going to do after graduation, how wonderful their lives are going to be. Meanwhile, we cut to God's boyfriend out behind the football fields, making out with some other girl, already planning to ditch God and leave her waiting at home. It makes the speech, and then you're going to do this, and do this, and then dolphin skins, and copper lavers, and the finest linen, and really nice spices. A little sad, honestly. God is already stooping. She's putting down the power she once had to make with language, a power where speaking and doing are identical, and offering this limited human husk of speech, asking with what I read as a sweet and vulnerable desire to be taken care of a certain way, even as the Israelites are preparing to betray her. There's a phrase in Hebrew, galut hadibur, the exile of speech. When the Israelites went down in Egypt, the rabbis tell us language too went into exile. This is why Moses talks about himself as slow of speech, as having an uncircumcised tongue. In one particularly beautiful image from the Zohar, Moses is described as voice, coming for the sake of speech to bring it out of exile. And when he arrives with the people at Sinai, voice and speech are finally reunited. Sinai in this framework represents the hope of an end to that exile. But Sinai happened 2 weeks ago. In theory, voice and speech are already one. God has spoken to the people from the top of the mountain. In fact, the rabbis describe the moment of God speaking directly to the Israelites in the erotic language of the Song of Songs. He kissed me with the kisses of his mouth. So what does it mean that we spend all this time listening to God give a set of instructions? Language separated from action, desire for a collectively built sanctuary that we know, even as it is being spoken, won't happen, at least not yet. This parsha in particular feels like a profound deflation, a poem chanted in a degraded and tawdry tongue. For most of the Torah, we lived under the theology of Genesis, in which language is a creative act, speaking is a doing. To speak is to be in relationship. God spoke to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. When someone speaks, the fabric of the world shifts. There are obligations that are enjoined somehow automatically. And here we are now in a theology of the desert, in which language does not make. Language explains. It describes. It can articulate desire, but there is no guarantee that that desire will be met with response. Language is an instruction manual left to crumple in a kitchen drawer somewhere. It's easy to ignore. I wonder where that leaves us. The horror of Israel's bombardment of Gaza continues to mount. It has reached such a fever pitch, and the silence of politicians, the hesitations, the couched language, the muteness of so many Jewish institutions feels like a degradation of all of us, a crumbling of our relationship to both language and action. And then there is social media. One posts, one doesn't post. The whole nightmare feels like it gets framed as hinging on the question of speech. Let us not remain silent, we say, and also, what do we believe our speech does? Are we living the theology of Genesis or the theology of the desert? What actually do we believe about the power of our language? I've been thinking a lot about how I was raised and educated. I was educated, I think, in the theology of Genesis, in which there was a vitality and a creativity to language and to the act of naming, inventing, narrating. I was raised to believe in specialness, that if you were smart or creative, you could do something of value in the world, that your speaking would conjure relationship, that hard work would be met with reward, that creativity could make change. And yet here we are. My creativity can't save a single life. I know now that I live, that we all live, under the theology of the desert. And what happens, I think, when we feel a crisis of this sort, a failure of language as action, is we shut down. I don't know what to do, and so I do nothing. I think that at the heart of this parsha is some sort of answer. The building of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is not a project for one person. It's a project of many hands. It requires everyone to bring gifts, everyone at least whose heart impels her to. It requires artists and designers and planners and craftspeople. It requires, I imagine, lots of spreadsheets and emails and Zoom meetings. And above the ark in which the tablets are to be kept, there are to be built two angels. Make one cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. The cherubim shall have their wings spread out above, and they shall confront each other. There I will meet you. The two angels face each other, literally a man to his brother. The JPS translates it as confront, which feels like an interpretive jump to me, but it's true that there's a sense of facing, of opposition. They're not with each other, they are to each other. And it is inside the space that God will meet with us. V'no'adati, ya'ad, an appointment, and also a kind of betrothal. There's another gorgeous reading of a line from Song of Songs that links our theology of the desert to the erotics of speech, the wilderness to God in her pink prom dress. Shmot Rabbah tells us, Ein midbar ela dibur. There is no desert, midbar, other than language, dibur. Why, the rabbis are asking, is the desert so essential to the history of our people? Because the experience of the desert is language. And they cite again, as if to seal the legitimacy of the pun between midbar and dibur, the Song of Songs. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, your mouth, midbarech, is lovely. For us, my dears, language isn't the kiss of God. Language is the desert. There is no desert other than language, and there is no language other than the desert. Language no longer guarantees relationships. It can no longer separate light from darkness or bring a world into being. It cannot end a war. Language will feel a little pathetic sometimes. Sometimes we'll be speaking words of love, getting all dolled up for the prom, only to realize later that our lovers were betraying us with some golden heifer. But that is language. Language as desire that won't always be fulfilled. Language as a vision, a set of possibilities that may not come to pass. And yet, that is not a reason to stop speaking. Ein dibur ela midbar. To actually build something requires action and collaboration and gifts and emails and meetings and artists and planners and administration. If we are to continue the work of creation, we are going to have to face each other and talk. That talk will not always correspond precisely or efficiently or neatly or consistently with action, but the building we need to do cannot happen without it. Cecilia Gentili was an organizer. I interviewed her once, and I told her when we finished that I'd send her a draft of what I'd written to get her okay before sending it to the editor. One wants to be respectful, you know, one doesn't want the wrong words to get out there in the world. "Oh no," she said, "it's fine. I'm sure it'll be fine." And she smiled. It's a small thing, but it stuck with me. Probably she just knew she was very busy. She's done a lot of interviews at this point. She wasn't worried about this one more. But also, it was a reminder that sometimes it's okay for words to get a little messy, as long as they're in the service of the work. Ein dibur ela midbar. This week's Parsha is an instruction manual, and we feel its limitations, its pathos, given the fickle, fucked up mess that are, at this point, the Israelite people, us. But we need it. And we do build eventually, and that's the important thing, between us, in the space where we do eventually face each other, we have a date with God. Our words aren't going to bring the world we dream into being. Our words are going to fall flat sometimes and land wrong. We're going to feel embarrassed sometimes for having spoken, but that doesn't mean we stop speaking. We try to speak in the hopes that our speaking might bring people together. We speak because we are still in the desert. We speak because we need each other. We speak because there are sanctuaries we still need to build. I'm seeing photos of Cecilia's funeral earlier this week in St. Patrick's motherfucking cathedral. She was sent onwards truly, truly in splendor. When we finally build our sanctuaries for this desert, they will be glamorous as fuck.
Experiencing intense closeness with God on top of a mountain, seeing beyond all obstacles. This is a Torah that is given to those in the shadow of that mountain, blocked from lofty consciousness by the limited and embodied life of human beings who feel pain. That experience, that knowledge of the life of the ger, is what allows the Torah to outlaw oppression, what allows it to be a healing gift. A world-transforming gift allows it not to just stay up in heaven, but to touch the earthbound. The Torah is not a gift that entirely soars above and beyond the physical in a transcendent space. It is one that is received through the physical, from the bottom up, not out of reach of the worst experiences of the human condition, but incorporating those experiences. When we are in great pain, depressed or shattered or terrorized, we are underneath the mountain. The Torah was given there too. There is no other place where its healing can be felt as deeply.